John, you're in a different place every time we meet.
Yeah, well, story of my life. Never know where I am. Okay, so this is July, and I thought what I'd do first before I start answering questions is to review this month's book, which is Story Grid 101. And I think this is going to be really good. And it's something, this is a process that I go through every time I have a new project. I always want to, solve it, go all the way down to the bottom of where all this thing started from. So I really want to get down to the foundational cement at the bottom of the methodology in order to have confidence as I'm moving forward and analyzing that all of these things are still locked and loaded in my mind. And so whenever I'm editing a project, whenever anybody asks me a question and I don't know what the answer is immediately, the first thing I do is go down to these sort of five first principles. So first principles come out of ancient Greece, and they're really, really, really helpful because they ask you the fundamental questions to think about so that you have a purpose, a teleology, as you are moving through your analysis, formulation, and mechanization. So the five, Leslie Watts and Shelley Speary and I worked on this project for a bunch of weeks, and they were extraordinarily helpful because they pointed out a lot of the things that I just kind of take for granted. So the very first principle, so this is like super, super bottom, is you can break a story down. So there are units of story. So the reason why this is important is a lot of people say, well, stories just come to me, and this whole idea of form and structure and story is just some kind of bullshit that somebody came up with. But when you really break it down, you say, well, let's look at the sum total of all stories throughout all time. Can we break that down from this big glob just in half? Can we just take it down to two halves? And the answer is of course, right? Because we have fiction and nonfiction. So nonfiction are stories that are told through the storyteller's interpretation of historical objective facts. And fiction is the many worlds theory of each of our fantastical ability to create avatars of human beings in our minds and tell stories of characters who are Homo sapiens-like but are avatars, right? So they're virtual human beings. So the reason why I'm breaking it down just into those two is so that everyone can kind of say, well, I'll go with him on that. I think there is fiction and nonfiction. Great. So once you go there, then you can start, letting the crystals fall, and you can look at fiction and, you can come up with some genres and things of, well, what kind of stories do we have? Same thing with nonfiction. So my entire genre framework is built off of that foundational first principle that there are units of story. So that's super, super, that's like the sand at the bottom of our foundation. The second first principle is that stories are about change. So stories are virtual reality simulations of events, unexpected events that drop into an avatar's life and force them to contend with that change. So it begins with change and it ends with change. It's the agent inside of the arena applying agency and changing over time. So all stories, this is like, again, a foundational first principle. If your units of story do not involve any change, you've got a big problem because it's not a story, right? So what all of these are, all these first principles are the necessities that we at StoryGrid believe in must be inside to just lock down all the necessities. There's a difference between necessity and sufficiency, right? So if you're making a fire, what's necessary is oxygen. But oxygen just doesn't give you fire, right? You need other necessities in order to have the sufficiency of a fire start. So a story has a lot of necessities, a shitload of them for a good reason. And even though you might have all the necessities, they might not sufficiently start the story fire. But the chances are that if you really focus on these necessities and really concentrate on them, that something magical will happen and a story will emerge that's far greater than the sum of its parts. Okay, so stories are about change. That's our second first principle. And remember that, like, oh, I've got a unit of story I'm working on. Let me see if something changed. Is there a clear beginning, middle, and end to this unit? Great. The third one is what kind of change? We need to answer that question. What kind of change are we talking about? Robert McKee has a famous statement that, you know, a change could be it's sunny outside, it rained, and then it's sunny again. Well, that's just not really meaningful change, right? So meaningful change has to be present. And how do we define meaningful change? Well, we define it based upon universal human values. So everyone knows that that's what we're talking about when we're talking about genres, right? So they're about specific universal human values. So an action story is about life and death. That's a universal human value. If you're dead, if you're unconscious, that's, you really value your consciousness. So there's a whole slew of universal human values, and they're linked to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which are linked to my framework for genre. So change occurs across a gradient of value in a universal life value, right? So a gradient is simply like, you know, light spectrum. So you fire some light through a prism and it breaks out all of these wavelengths, right? So a value is like a beam of light, and you shine it through a prism, and the gradient of value emerges once you analyze that specific value. So, you know, in the long-term 10-year plan for StoryGrid, we would have all these values and the gradients of value really well delineated with high resolution. You know, that's one of these wonderful goals that I have that has to be, it's not prioritized right now because we can generally understand life and death, etc. Okay, so that's the third principle. Change concerns the shift in value of a universal life value. That's our third first principle. Our fourth first principle is that units, story units, have events. And what an event is, it's a one sentence or a phrase. I always like to keep them as short as possible. Distillation, so we're distilling, coagulating what happens in this unit of story. So what happened on the ground plus what value shifted, what value changed. So it's all about what literally happened in the scene plus the value shift. Sean goes on a job interview, doesn't get the job. That's an event, right? And that could be a really great scene. So we can boil down an entire getting the job scene and interview scene. And we've reviewed these in, I think we did a Stephen King scene. So that interview scene can be boiled down to man interviews for job, gets job. So that's what the fourth first principle is that units of story can be distilled down to an event. Even a beat can be distilled down to an event. I talk about beats in terms of the actor's craft because it's very salient to me. So when you're acting, you're always taught to be reading the other actor, right? So you're the ideal actor doesn't go in with an algorithmic series of acting choices, right? This is why it's so freaking hard. What you do is you have this big sort of like a delicatessen has all those different kinds of foods. So you have this big delicatessen tray full of tools, acting tools. And what you're supposed to do is look at the other actor, and what they give you, you react to the action that's given to you. So if someone's being negative to me or like confronting me, I would have to, in the moment, pull out the tool of, you know, cooling them down. That's a tool. Calming someone down. But I use the language that the writer gave me to do it. It's awesome. So even beats have these distilled moments of event. So after, like when you see a great play or watch a great movie and you analyze the acting, you can point out those great moments. And we all know who these great actors are. Like Meryl Streep on the screen, you just go, holy crap. How is she so locked in to the moment? She's constantly reading the environment, and she's reading her other actors, and she's got a teleology, a purpose already locked in. It's amazing. So I'll get off of that. Units have events. That's our fourth. And now the fifth one is we've been talking about the big sort of macro conceptual foundational elements now. And so now we've got this great foundation, and now we're going up to number five, which is really the first principle of our microanalysis. So this is the five commandments of storytelling, right? So the five commandments of storytelling are inciting incident, progressive complications that reach a turning point, crisis, climax, and resolution. Now, I've always been, you know, for forever, I never really had the time until I devoted myself to this full time. But I always wondered, where did the hell did that come from? And I would ask, you know, the experts, and they would sort of be like, oh, well, yeah, they're just fundamentals. And I always wondered, these are really good. Like, they're very useful. But where the hell did they come from? And it wasn't until I spent, you know, the past 5 years really self-teaching myself cognitive science that I actually figured out that these are the processes by which we enact motor actions. So they're literally mapped onto our neural function, our cognitive functioning, and it's awesome. So the inciting incident is the moment of an unexpected change from the environment. And so what happens next is that the protagonist or whoever's in the scene, usually it takes them a little while to figure out that it's even there. So there's a famous experiment called the invisible gorilla experiment, which immediately explains exactly what I'm talking about. So you can just go to Google and put in invisible gorilla and watch it, and you'll go, oh my gosh, that's fascinating. So So when somebody's really concentrated on a goal, they don't tune in information that has nothing to do with the goal. So it's so remarkably, we're so good at focusing our attention on our goal state that literally a gorilla can walk into our field of vision and we don't see it. So I love that analogy, because when you're telling a story, I always say to myself, what's the invisible gorilla here? Like, a gorilla just walked into this scene and my protagonist hasn't quite figured it out yet. And so that process of the protagonist or the person in the scene figuring out that something isn't quite right here, that is the progressive complication, right? So it's like the gorilla's like, hey, here I am, don't see him. And then they start yelling, still don't see, don't hear. And then eventually the gorilla touches you, and maybe that third sensory input is the one that makes the character realize, holy shit, things have changed, right? And that's the turning point, progressive complication. That's the moment when the protagonist realizes that the value has shifted. And then that process moves into, you know, the black box in your brain. So you finally register the input. It goes into your brain 2.0. And the brain 2.0 does a lot of calculations. And it spits out an output. And the output is a binary choice. It's a binary choice, a best bad choice, or an irreconcilable good choice. So this binary choice is really, really cool. I won't get into it here, but we do have two hemispheres of our brain, right? So binary is really an important thing to remember, because you have dichotomies, paradoxes. We have nuance. Something can be both things at the same time. So this is why our brain brings things down to a crisis. And then what happens after the crisis is that output is then processed, and then we make a choice. We enact a choice, and we send a signal to our bodies to for motor action, either a verbal, my dryer keeps going on. It's either a verbal action in dialogue or monologue or interior monologue, or it's a physical action, but it's a motor action on the ground. It goes absolutely into the arena or the environment. That's important to remember. So when we apply our agency through choice, we enact a motor action that goes into the arena. And then lastly, we get resolution. The arena or the environment tells us how that went. You know, what did it work or did it not work? If it worked, then we go, oh, I'm going to do more of that. If it didn't work, then we have to come up with something else. This is the on-the-ground movement of a story. It's the micro progression of story in multiple units. It's packed on each other. They're like these spheres that are like amazingly moving together in time and space. So these five first principles, whenever you get lost, you can sort of filter down into these five first principles. For example, say you're not sure about your genre. You go, well, where the hell did genre come from anyway? Did Sean just make that crap up? Well, let's go back to our five first principles. Let's see. Principle number one, stories can be divided into smaller units. Oh, great. So that's where genre comes from. And then you can keep walking down these five principles. And then you see that the universal human values are attached, coupled to genre. And then you can answer all kinds of questions following the yellow brick road of that genre. And, you know, we're constantly trying to refresh and give a higher resolution to the answers to all those questions. some of the questions, we haven't even figured out the question yet. So this is a work in progress, but these five first principles are always going to, at the very least, get you back on track, get you back to the core, and you will be able to reconfigure from these. So it's like if I talk about top-down processing and bottom-up processing. So if you're having trouble with your macro vision and you really need to start from first principles, you just go to StoryGrid 101 and go, okay, yeah, I'll start there. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. Oh, and that happens and that happens. And then you start constructing from the bottom up instead of top down. Instead of saying, geez, I don't know why my novel doesn't work. That's a big ass question, isn't it? It's a really big question. So you got to break that question, that problem. Ooh, you got to really get down to the floorboards to start figuring that out. So anyway, our plan is to make StoryGrid 101 a free ebook so that if one of your friends is like, what's this StoryGrid crap about? You can go, hey, just go to the free ebook. And if you think that those five first principles are useful, then you might want to play around in this garden with me, because everything is built from this. These are all the nutrients that make all of the plants in this StoryGrid garden. Okay, so I think that's it for that. If anybody has any questions about that, just shoot them in the thing, and I'll start answering. Oh, good, that was 20 minutes. If you give me 1 minute, I'm just going to turn off my dryer so it doesn't go off.
All right.
Okay.
You ready for the first question?
Sure.
All right. From Krista, does a morality plot require a sophisticated protagonist, or can the selfishness to selflessness arc work for a younger YA protagonist as well? Or for YA, does making a moral decision to change one's pattern of behavior coincide more with a worldview shift?
Well, as I was just saying, our concepts are constantly being under my laser focused gaze. And here's the state of my art of thinking about morality and worldview. And I'll answer the morality question in a minute, but I want to frame this so that it can click a little bit for everybody. I have now come to the conclusion that there are three sort of guiding macro story forms. And don't worry, all of this I've talked about before. It's just a new sort of reconfiguration. So these aren't brand new story forms, okay? And I know I've talked about this before, but I see the motor action of on-the-ground action as action story. So action story sort of forms the micro on-the-ground movement of any story. And that's why we have so many of those subgenres of action, right? Because there are many different plot devices that you can pick and choose from there and then play around with the other genres. Okay, so if the story is Earth, Earth is action. And so people are moving around Earth in an action story. Cool. Now, at the very sort of top, above the clouds, is worldview. And worldview is the process by which someone enacts their agency. So remember, you have the agent in the arena with agency. So this is one of the greatest concepts ever come up with, because it's so true. All of us are agents in a global arena that includes everything. And we all have agency. And our agency is just our ability to make choices and to enact them either verbally or physically. So our motor actions are the applications are of our agency. So the worldview, and you can see how these are so tightly embedded and linked. They're so tightly coupled. So you've got the on the ground action, and then you've got the above clouds worldview. The worldview informs the motor action on the ground. And the motor action on the ground goes back up into the worldview. It's like the Buddha imagery where he's sitting there like a lotus. And the flower goes up into the air and it goes deep down into the water too. So it's sort of this really cool thing. Now, what's in between worldview and action? Here, I'll try and frame this better. Up here is worldview and here's action. And then what do we have is all this liminal space that concerns Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So we want to sort of, like a lotus flower, like the Buddha, we want to move up this hierarchy of needs. And so those are our two sort of genres that frame everything. And so we can put flavor on the action genre by using, say, love story or performance story. And there are little conventions and obligatory moments in each of those levels of genre. Okay, so those are our two. Now, guess what? There's a third. And the third is the heroic journey. It's the monomythic progression of the central universal interpretation of experience. So there's being and there's becoming. And so the heroic journey, I'm really, really sort of wiping the whiteboard clean on Campbell's interpretation, getting far more back to Jung. But even with the Jung, the archetypes are awesome. But I think it's far more, I'm still working on it, so I don't want to. So anyway, so we have these three macro forms, and they're like three rings that are linked together and never touch. And they just sort of move around from micro to micro scene. And there's a three-dimensional axis that these things travel on. So let's get back. All right, so that's like a preview for Story Grid, probably 5.9 or 6. I don't know. I hope it gets higher and higher and higher. And that's what all your jobs are. Okay, so so let's get back to morality. All right, so I used to have morality as the outer limit. I used to have it as the boundary. And now I put worldview up there. And I've sort of knocked morality down beneath worldview. Because worldview is the process by which we come into our morality, right? So it's almost like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? In my estimation, cognition came before the delineation of moral behavior. I think it's an evolutionary development. Once consciousness came online, then these other things started to develop and emerge. So morality, let me just check my notes. Morality has three subgenres, and they are the redemption plot, the testing plot, and the punitive plot. Okay, so just in that description, what we can talk about is the nature of the protagonist. Now, in a morality story, your protagonist is going to have many different sub-personalities. Let me just take a step back. In many cases in the morality plot, your protagonist is going to be an anti-hero. And what I mean by that is that they are going to be sort of lost. they're committed to a specific one ideological point of view at the beginning of the story. In a redemption plot, they're living in chaos at the beginning. They're living in all is lost. Their belief is that nothing matters. So fuck it. That's their belief, generally. So the process in a redemption plot, and you can just map this on, you know, Rocky. You know, it's pretty clear. So he has to come into acceptance of the necessity for him to become, to self-generate his ethos, logos, and pathos in one form, as he's a fighter. That's his essence. And he's got to fight authentically. So the anti-heroic idea moves, and then he redeems himself at the end. I don't want to get into the details of Rocky. I've talked about it a lot. It's a great, great genre. The Verdict's another great one. Anyway, okay. So I think the question concerns, how do you deal with morality in a YA book? And the answer that Tim and I kind of figured out when we were working on The Threshing is that to look at the development of morality as a maturation into an understanding of the nuances of behavior. So Jesse in the story, it's not really a morality story, but she does confront the reality of good and evil, and she has to make a choice. Should I contribute to the death or imprisonment of another human being for reasons that haven't been fully, you know, told to me yet? That's a moral choice. And when it's a child, it's extraordinarily difficult because we as children, when we're maturing, our brains really aren't that good for quite a long time, having the ability to second order think, right? So second order thinking is thinking about your thinking. So whenever we get in a jam, we go, geez, I wonder why the hell I keep doing this, right? That's second order thinking. So a kid, that's a developmental stage. And it's usually, you know, in adolescence. That's why it's such a freaking painful part of life, because you start to look at yourself from the omniscient point of view. And you start saying, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm just some ant on this planet. And, you know, I just don't fit in. I don't know what I'm doing. I make these stupid mistakes. I threw up in the lunchroom because I ate too fast. You know, there's a million things that you do that you have to navigate and learn. So if you're writing a YA book and there's a morality component to it, and there will be whether you think about it or not, I would not recommend starting the story with the protagonist being too anti-heroic, right? So Jessie's a little bit anti-heroic at the beginning because she's a thief. But she's a thief in a dystopia. So it kind of works. Like, that's the heroic choice, to fight the dystopia. So she comes off as heroic, even though technically she's anti-heroic. And she ends up heroically blowing up the entire system. But that has a lot of second, third, fourth order effects that Tim hasn't figured out yet.
I figured out a few of them.
Oh, good. All right. So that's kind of my answer about morality in YA is, it's kind of like draft number 7 to look at and say, do they really come into the understanding that there's, you know, these shades of gray of moral behavior? And usually it's baked into your plot. So it's probably already there. But the redemption story, there's a little testing. There's a little redemption. This is why all of us can read into stories what we wish to. Like our frame, I'm going to be like, I'm looking morality the whole time. And other people are like, that was a great, you know, action story. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, it's really about, you know. So that's why you have, I have this new conception of this lotus flower, because where you are in the observer-verse is going to influence your take on a particular story. All right, let's move to the next question. I hope that's helpful.
Well, this is a quick follow-up from Thomas. Is it correct to say that worldview concerns our search for what is true and morality concerns our search for what is good and right?
It's a little more complex than that. Worldview is our, I'll use an analogy of like sort of a, it's our operating system. So like I talk about upgrading the story grid operating system, our worldview operating system is primal. So morality is a subcomponent of that operating system. And our operating system, I'm sorry to be so computery in this, but I think it's a good analogy. So the worldview operating system operates on two sort of ways to navigate the world and to avoid combinatorial explosion, right? So one of them is to figure out algorithms, which are just simple, like, oh, I put the coffee grounds in the Mr. Coffee, pour water in, hit the button. That's an algorithm, right? I don't even have to think about it anymore. It's just habitual. And then we have heuristics, right? So the heuristic is more like the rules of thumb. Like a rule of thumb in my family is don't ask dad for anything or challenge his mind in any way after 7:30 at night because I'm done. And I get triggered quickly. My emotional response is just fire. And I'll be like, what are you? And they'll just like, oh, it's 7:30. My mistake, right? So that's a heuristic. So our heuristics and our algorithms confront, as we mature and develop, they start to come up against the mother of all existential problems. And that's the search for meaning. Why the hell am I here? What am I supposed to do? And is there any point to it? So now that, when you come up against that thing, usually around adolescence, that is something that will torment you until you die. So you don't stop developing after adolescence. And if you do, you're in trouble because you're going to spiral down into despair and nothingness. And you're going to end up, you know, being in Fight Club. You know, it's not good. So the morality is the search for the answer to meaning. And the morality, because there's no, this is extraordinarily difficult to accept. There is no pure answer to what's good and what's bad. So everything has both components. It's a spectrum of gradient of value, right? So food is good. It gives life. Too much food kills you. So is food good or bad? Well, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on the micro context of your navigation of the world. It's not right to kill anybody, is it? Well, it depends. If somebody comes into your house and is threatening your family and you can kill them and save your family, you're gonna do it. And that's a moral choice, but it's constrained by the context of the moment. So to say morality stories are all about delineating good and bad, yeah. But it's also about confronting the big existential problems that bear down on us every moment of our life. So there's a lot of nuance between morality and worldview, but you know, push comes to shove, I think it's, we have to keep updating our operating system to be able to apply our motor actions for moral, to make the correct moral choices. And that's called rationality in my estimation. So, and rationality is built on things like first principles. So you see how I keep cycling back to these first principles of what is the world all about and how do I navigate it? Well, I need some food, right? I gotta survive. That's number one. You know, if I'm scuba diving and my oxygen goes out, I'm not thinking about anything but getting to the surface because I need that air or I'm gonna die. So that's gonna really be central in my mind. And then when I'm out, then I might be like, hey, I wonder what I'm gonna have for lunch. I'm gonna wanna thrive. How do I satisfy my desires, right? And so then I start to go up that hierarchy of needs. And eventually I run into, after I've had 3,000 cheeseburgers, I have a house, I have a car, I have a healthy family, then I'm like, well, maybe this having thing, there might be something else besides just having shit. And then I keep going up. And that's a painful realization too. And then eventually you come up to that grand mother of all problems, which is, what's the point of this again? Why? Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? How do I transcend myself so that at the very least I can just say, as I'm tipping off into the unknown and dying, hey, you know what? I gave it my best shot and I left this place a little better than when I got it. I think it's a little bit better, a micro bit better. And that, I think, is the heroic pursuit. And the anti-heroic pursuit, the flip of that, is when you believe in only one thing, that everything is nothing. And when there's nothing, then it's a scarcity situation. And then you're just out to get whatever you can get, and all of your wants, you know, it's just like diminishing returns of dopamine rush. Okay. Sorry.
All right. So a couple questions here about antagonists and monsters in particular. So what, I'm going to try to combine them together. What advice do you have for creating the antagonist of a story? How are the villain and hero alike and how are they different? In a horror story, how does the monster reflect the good and evil in other characters of the story? And then a similar question about another... In a recent podcast interview, Philip Athens, who wrote Writing Monsters, mentioned, quote, monsters as metaphor. So what are your thoughts on writing monsters? So antagonists, okay, and monsters in particular.
Antagonists concern this dichotomy between our desire to be meaningful and our fear that everything isn't meaningful. So the anti-hero believes, the anti-hero meaning the antagonist. So, and when I say anti-hero, that's usually, I'm referring to a story like Breaking Bad, where we're like locked into a character that we're hoping will redeem himself, but also like, yeah, we want to see some more bad stuff. So, the antagonist, however, is the yang to the yin of the protagonist. So the way I describe it in the action beat is that you've got your luminary agent and you've got your shadow agent. And the shadow agent is a believer in scarcity and that everything is nothing. So they believe that life is meaningless. So since we're here, let's have a good time and let's get while the getting's good. Or let's make heaven on earth and get everybody to do the quote unquote right thing that they have decided. So they have a single idea about what the right thing is, and then they want to tyrannically enforce their ideology on everyone else because they know what's best. That's an antagonist. A protagonist is a luminary agent. And what the luminary agent is really about doing is shining the light on the noumenal, the unknown. Okay, so you've got this back and forth between the protagonist and the antagonist, and you'll always see in a lot of action stories when the antagonist will say something to the protagonist like, "Hey, you know, you and I are a lot alike. Why don't you join my side? Come on aboard. You know, we just have a few little, you know, small things that we disagree on. Join me and we'll rule this place together." Right? That's the last temptation scene. But that's not true, because the luminary agent is a believer in creation, in a believer in abundance, a believer in shining the light into the darkness to pull out something out of nothing, right? So they believe that there's something that comes out of nothing. They're not saying that there isn't moments of nothingness, and it's painful, but nothingness is the thing from which something grows. Sorry about my dogs. It's garbage day too here. So all right, now monster. All right, so I hope that's clear. So it's this really interesting sub-psychological examination of the struggle that we all have. So within all of us, we have a shadow agent and a luminary agent, and we're constantly flipping. Quiet! Now, a monster is different. A monster is representative of the unknowable darkness of just evil. Evil that just does not give a shit about anything. So that's representative of the unexpected disasters that befall us on Earth. So the flood, holy shit, where did this flood come from? Well, it was just a meteorological, you know, random event that ended up killing X number of people, right? It's a thematic monster. There's nothing you can do. The flood doesn't care about you. Why should it, right? So there's a presence in the universe, in the unknown, that is just doesn't care. And it's a destructive force. So there's creation in the numinous. There's also destruction, right? I mean, it was a big bang. It was a destructive act that brought creation, which is a real mind puzzle. So the monster, as a horror story, the monster is intractable evil. It's representative of the uncertain random nature of disastrous situations. You can accidentally fall off a cliff. You can get hit by a truck. You can catch a virus. The virus doesn't give a shit, right? So the virus is not good or bad, it just is. It has its essence, which is to what? Survive and thrive. But it doesn't have any meaning beyond survive and thrive. So you slice away meaning from the monster. And that's a monster. So it doesn't have that third component, that search for meaning. It meaning, who cares? I just want to eat. And I don't care if you're really nice or not nice. So sugar in No Country for Old Men is a monster. He's just randomness. Flip the coin. What you stand to win is everything. What you stand to lose is everything. I don't care. I don't care how the coin flips. That is the embodiment of evil, because they don't have any interest in morality. It's not on the table for them. So yeah, I mean, a monster is definitely a metaphor. It's a metaphor for our confronting the unexpected events of the universe, those things I call fears, right? So horror stories just dumps that real phenomena in front of us. And we have to somehow find a meaning to overcoming that. And so when, you know, our morality is like, thou shalt not kill, bullshit, kill that monster. Because it's either you or them, and they're meaningless. They could care less about creation. They just want to devour the universe. It's like cancer. I mean, do you know how ridiculous cancer is? All it wants to do is eat the body until it kills the body. So it's killing itself through its consumption. That's a monster. It doesn't even, it can't forward think that, oh, well, if I kill this person, I'll die because I'm living off of them. So that's an agent in an arena that's going to destroy the arena, right? So if you look at cancer and you say it's thematically a monster because it doesn't have any turnoff switch, there's no turnoff to cancer. And you're damn right, we go in there and we try and kill that thing with everything we have. So that's what a monster is, and that's the difference between an antagonist and a protagonist. They live in the same sort of mental space. Hopefully, some people believe that there were genetic Homo sapiens monsters, and all of the true crime books that I've published in my life lead me to believe that that is actually possible. That I do think that there is a genetic condition that robs someone of any ability to care. And they're monstrous. Okay.
All right. Couple of questions about sequences. The first is, what are they and how do you use them? And then, do sequences or sections of interstitial, do sequences between scenes also need the five C's, the five commandments?
Yeah, I mean, any unit of story has to have that neural firing progression of five commandments. A sequence is really about entertainment in many ways, because a sequence is a means by which you move the audience thematically from one worldview shift to another. So a sequence could be something like getting the job. So we watch the person, you know, get ready for the interview, and then they go to the interview, and we watch that scene. And it's like in the Bridget Jones story, there's a getting the job sequence that's maybe 3 minutes, and it's extraordinarily well done. It's fast, it's quick, it's funny. Richard Curtis, who wrote that, he wrote the screenplay. He's really good at sequences. So he came up with, he thinks in sequences. So he's, the guy who wrote Four Weddings and a Funeral. And so he thought, like, I got my five sequences knocked. And then I've got my characters, and I'll just dab them in all the things. And then at the beginning and the end, then, I mean, it's so simple a construction. It's so elegant. And so we all go, oh, that's cool. I'm going to get to see five sequences and I'm going to go. So think of sequences in those terms. Like, there's the big sequence of the fight at the end of Rocky. So that's the whole ending payoff of the story. In performance stories, it's all building to the big sequence at the end. In a war story, it's all building to that big battle at the end. So, and then it has to turn and do all that stuff. So the sequence could be anything from a couple of scenes to Steve Pressfield talks about, like, he likes to do the David Lean, like, seven sequence concept. So he thinks in terms of seven big sequences. Like, this is 5 days of shooting on the Sahara Desert. And then we're going to do 5 days of shooting in Bletchfield, England, or whatever. So when you think of sequences, it's sort of like the big, you know, motion picture director, like Catherine Bigelow. She's probably always thinking in sequences. And they're great because they're, you know, you can come up with five to seven of these things, and you can break down your beginning hook into two sequences, right? So in Tim's book, the opening sequence is her stealing. Then it moves to her, you know, the ramifications of her stealing and her being shamed and thrown into the number. Then it's life with the number. Then it's transition into the new world. Then it's, right, so it's all these sequential things, and each one of them contain three, two, three, four, five scenes, but they all have beginning, middles, and ends. Now, if you overdo it and think about all of these five commandments for all levels of your story, you're going to drive yourself crazy. So just like I was suggesting earlier about checking morality in a YA book later on in the game to just make sure it's there. And if it's not, it might be like, there's a lot of things that Tim was able to fix with a sentence or two that were critical conventions that had to be in there, but it wasn't a big, massive fix. So sequences, I would almost recommend, think about, it depends on the way you think. If you think in big movements of story, those are sequences. And you're going to, a lot of people would call them acts, like the seven act thing or whatever. But if you're more like, let me just see how this moves, then think of sequences after the fact that you have a draft. But you can get really, you know, crazy if you're thinking about the five commandments for your beats, for your scenes, for your sequences, for your acts. It's just too much. And the fact is, if your scenes have the five commandments, they're pretty, it's pretty good chance that your sequences will too.
Okay. What is the difference between the global genre and the external genre on the Foolscap?
Oh, well, the global genre is your specific creation choice of what is your North Star for your story. So I could, if I was writing Rocky, and I think he probably thought of this too, he saw it as a redemption story. He didn't see it as a boxing story, but he saw it as redemption. So that would be his global genre choice. The external genre would be then performance. Sports performance or sub whatever. But okay, then let's say for like, I'm sorry for all these silly male references, but I remember Oliver Stone did a movie on football, right? Now, he was just like, I'm going to do a movie about football. So he was all performance. That was his global genre. And then he's like, well, how can I make this interesting? I really want to do something about professional football. And then he did a multi-character bunch of stories, like Al Pacino was the gruff coach and, you know, what was he going to do? And then you had the guy who was on his last legs who was going to. So he constructed his story using the global genre as performance. And then he put all these little subgenres underneath it that were generated by specific characters. So when I say global genre, that's the one that if somebody held a gun to your head and said, what's your story about? You go, so it's a redemption morality plot, or it's a performance story, or it's, you know, it's a legal thriller, whatever. So that's the distinction. So if your global genre is an internal one, your external genre would be underneath it. So they work in sync.
Okay. This one's from Mary. Could you explain free and direct style?
Sure. Free and indirect style was, I think, you know, it is a 19th century psychotechnology that emerged because like the novels prior to like Flaubert and Jane Austen and all those people, they were very much in the grand third person omniscient godlike narration. So like Stendhal's Red and the Black was, you know, from Mount Olympus talking about the protagonist. Quiet. So what happened with like I think it was Jane Austen or Flaubert, one of those people was just like, I really want to know what's in this character's head. And so what they did is they kept that third person omniscient point of view, but then they would sort of like take the camera down into the head of one character. So in Pride and Prejudice, you can see like about midpoint, we start to hear Elizabeth's thoughts. And then we're like, oh, and it feels very organic and we don't even realize it. And then we start to understand just what her worldview processing is doing, which is very enlightening to us as the audience. And it connects us to her even more. So free and direct style is the use of getting into the character's mind and literally having their thoughts without any like she thought. So it was just, Silence of the Lambs, Thomas Harris does it with Clarice in the second or third chapter. And then you can keep coming back to it. And he even uses it with Jack Crawford every now and then. So it's a technique that gives you the best of both worlds. It allows you as the storyteller to use the first person sensibility inside of a third person omniscient general narrative. Now, a lot of people get a little bit confused here because there also is I think they call it like limited third person omniscient. And what limited third person omniscient is that it's sort of like, it's not on Mount Olympus, they bring the camera down and then they keep moving the camera to characters. So you will be able to see the world through the eyes of a specific character. George R. R. Martin does this, right? And whether or not you hear their thoughts or not is not, it's really up in the air. But that's another way of handling the ability to show point of view, but also have the grand sort of godlike narration. But free and direct style is specifically about hearing the character's internal thoughts, reading them, sharing them without, she said or he thought or, yeah. So just eliminating those things gives, it's a trick. It's a really good trick. But you can't do it too much. I highly recommend that you never do it with more than, you do it very sparingly and you do it really in high moments of tension where the person is sort of like cycling in their mind, holy shit, what are they gonna do now? So, that's it.
Okay. We'll end with this one. In the original Story Grid book, you mentioned buddy love is a sub genre of love, but in the LUIC Level Up Your Craft course, you talk about love as being about romantic love, obsession, courtship, or marriage. Do you think the buddy love belongs in a different genre now?
No. I would say that buddy love is it's definitely in love and it concerns extended cognition and empathy. So that is many philosophies and religions define the extended cognitive capacity of a human being, meaning having empathy for someone else to the point where you'll give your life for them. as it's absolutely in that love domain. It's certainly not romantic or sex driven. So it's decoupled from the procreation and the fundamental need to reproduce. But it's also about this idea of we're all in this shit together. So the buddy love story is very appealing to everyone because we all know that's a fundamental truth. You know, we're all on this thing together. Doesn't matter. There's one arena and we're all in it. That's it. I mean, when you really come right down to it, we're all agents in a big arena. And cognitively, together, the things that we could create, the problems we can fix, are off the charts. I mean, crazy. If we collectively join forces and stopped polarizing for exploitation of consumer goods or power for a minute, just a minute. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense that we don't have a Manhattan Project for COVID-19. Come on, like we can pull the smartest people together to blow up the earth, but anyway, I'm a biologist, so it's even more infuriating. So the buddy story is all about this agapic love. Agapic love is the creative process. So creation is really great when we all self-actualize and transcend and we all write our little stories and they affect other people in third-party ways, but we never have to meet them. That's okay. That's great. It's amazing. But what's really agape is when we have a participatory situation where we've got buddy love with everyone. And we all say, hey, this is a big ass problem. Let's get a couple of pots of pop coffee. We'll get some whiteboards and we'll, you know, get a whole bunch of takeout food and let's figure this shit out. And then we start at first principles. Well, what's the problem? Well, we want to know what storytelling's about. Okay, let's put that on the board. Story, big problem. All right, can we divide this fucker in half? Yeah. Okay. And then that's where we go. And then we share our ideas. And so that's agape. And participatory knowledge is far faster and far more powerful than the monk sitting in his shed. Now, the problem for me and for, the problem that I see with our shared love of story is that it's shocking to me that it hasn't really been the focus of any intellectual endeavor beyond this magical thinking idea every now and then you've got Edith Wharton writing about it and thinking about it, and you've got other people who are doing it, but nobody really takes it seriously as a science, which is just an abomination to me. So I've done 30 years by myself doing it. And of course, and so I can play tennis at a pretty high level, and all of you guys are really good tennis players, but I've got to keep hitting the ball against the wall by myself and then share it with you, and then you can react. So the buddy love story is about agape. It's about joining forces together and being willing to die for the other one. Like, it would be, you would much rather die in the service of saving them than to live and sacrifice them. So that's love at, it's a really high moral value. And love is that liminal genre, right? It's got, it's got all kinds of stuff. And it feeds all the other genres. So the reason why I defined love in Level Up Your Craft and Ground Your Craft and in the Love Seminar as romantic love is that's the most popular form of love story, is two people coming together. And so this other one's great, but it's sort of like a subset of a subset of a subset. So yeah, I'd love to do a whole thing on buddy romance, buddy love story. And it eventually I will.
All right, do we have time for one more real quick?
Sure.
All right, let's do one more. I'm having a challenge distinguishing between worldview maturation and worldview revelation. What is the distinction between naivete and ignorance and then knowing and worldliness when it comes to distinguishing which subplot?
So I'm sorry, maturation and revelation? Okay.
Yeah, worldview maturation, worldview revelation.
Okay, so that's another thing that I need to give more higher resolution to. So the fact that it's you're finding it puzzling and a little confusing makes sense to me. So first of all, you're not crazy for being a little bit confused about that. Now, the difference between revelation and maturation, maturation is all about developing cognitive capacity. Revelation is about finding an operating system for your operating system. So it's the meta of, it's like heuristics are tools to help specific problems. If you have a global heuristic, it helps you create heuristics. So the revelation story is, you know, it's a big ass story because it's like the clouds part and the character thinks and can really make a great case that this new information is revelatory for all humanity. So it's a big story. Now you can have smaller revelations, which are called insights. So the insight process is a worldview transformation. It's how we learn to upgrade our software. And there's a deep, deep scientific history of how that works that I won't get into. But maturation is about development, and revelation is about coming to a grand heuristic of heuristics. So again, these are very, very micro, high resolution distinctions that practically are probably not worth considering. If you just categorize worldview as the means by which someone changes their mind, I was one way, now I think a different way. And the way we do that is building through the knowledge, the four quadrants of knowledge. So when all we rely upon are propositions, we're in trouble because there are untested ideas and thoughts in our mind. And we're constantly being battered with propositions from the internet and all over the place. And the propositions are very tantalizing because they seem really true. Now, so that's, in my estimation, that's the lowest level of knowledge, is propositional knowledge. Then you sort of cycle up to procedural knowledge. Now, procedural knowledge is when the body can do things that the mind can't really explain. So propositions are all mind stuff. They're ideas. Story grid is a proposition until it becomes an effective mechanism. And this is why we talk about procedures. All right, so procedures are when the body does things. Like I can catch a baseball and I can't explain to you how. I can throw a baseball and hit a specific target. And if I started explaining to you how I did it, it wouldn't make any sense and it would be ridiculous. So my mind and my body coordinate that thing that I do, that procedure, and it's amazing. So that's a procedure. Knowing the five commandments is an analytical procedure. So that's important for all of you to do as much as you can all the time. Because you're practicing. It's like if you want to be a Major League Baseball pitcher, you got to practice your procedure and get better at it, right? Nobody just walks into Major League Baseball and is a pitcher. It takes them years and years and years and years of crap. So that's procedural knowledge. But once they have that knowledge, then they can forget about it. And then they just go low and outside. That's what I'm going to throw. And there it goes. And it's there. All right. So that's procedural knowledge. The third level is perspectival knowledge. Perspectival knowledge is when you have a new vision, a new understanding of the domain of your procedural knowledge. So let's just play with this idea of the Major League Baseball pitcher. So when David Cohn, who's I'm a Yankee fan, so I hear him all the time. David Cohn, when he first came on and started pitching, he was a fastball pitcher, right? And his stuff was so good, he was great. And as he got older, his skills, you know, depleted. So he had to get a new perspective on how to throw. So he couldn't throw in the 90s anymore. So then he had to learn a new pitch. He had to change his perspective. He had to learn about the tendencies of the other hitters who came up to the plate. So you go, oh, I struck that guy out 2 weeks ago with the low outside pitch. So let me try this. I'll do a change up inside. So his perspective of how to be successful has completely shifted. That's a maturation process. That's deep, awesome knowledge. So when you're an editor, having a perspectival understanding is really important, because the way I can help one writer isn't going to work for another writer. So I need to change my perspective based upon the stimulus and the signals that I'm getting from the individual that I'm working for. That's nuance. That's living in a context of playing in the arena, listening, and then responding that will work. All right, lastly is the best knowledge that we can all have is participatory. And that means that when you're playing tennis with an equally good player, you're sort of at the same level, both of you get better. So you participate in hitting the ball back and forth, and you learn more as the ball is being going back and forth. So participatory knowledge is incredible, because it's fast and it levels you up very, very quickly. This is the whole concept of the guild, right? So all of you are equal tennis players right now. And so you can all level up because you're poking the tennis pro, and then you'll try it out when you go back to the court. And maybe it'll work, and maybe it won't. You go, the pro screwed me up on that. Let me try something else. So this is worldview maturation. And this is why it is, in my estimation, it's the cellular wall of story. It's the boundary that we need to expand. So the more our cognition and our skill sets and our knowledge expands, the more we have contact with the unknown, the more we can pull out from that nothingness new things. So that's generally the movement of a story from start to the end in a worldview story, is the character has a mind reframing. And yeah, they have to go into the shithole to get it. They've got to hit, this is why it's a negative emotional state. A friend of mine was having a lot of trouble yesterday, and she was very concerned about just the negative relationships in her family. And so what she told me was that she feels bad because people have differences of opinion and they don't want to talk to each other, and it's really everybody's feeling really badly and it's terrible. And what I said to her was, that's actually a pretty good sign. Because what it means is that everyone in your family is running their code and it's not working. And the people that they love, they know they love. They've been with them forever. And they're hating them right now because they're saying things and they're thinking things that don't make sense to them, to the other person. So each person in their family is in this hole. And what I said to her is like, that's what heroes do. And the way our bodies work is that when you are processing a lot of information, your body freaks out. And it says, man, you're burning a lot of glucose in that brain, and we gotta slow that shit down, man. And so what it does is it sucks up your dopamine. So the dopaminergic pathway doesn't flow like it usually does. And so you get a little depressed. You might get really depressed. But when I hit that place, and I tell myself this all the time, and it still is very difficult to remember. So when I get down, I start to think, oh, everything sucks. I'm never gonna figure this out. It's all horrible. And then I remember, holy shit, I must really be churning through this thing because my dopamine is way down. So that's a good time to like try and pump up your dopamine by going outside, maybe walking around, go for a bike, you know, do a bike ride, go swimming, do something to just sort of get some dopamine firing again. And guess when you return, then you can start back on it. But the hero understands that the only way novelty emerges is going into chaos, and chaos sucks dopamine. You know, it goes. So when you're feeling down, say to yourself, okay, I'm feeling down, which means I'm onto something. If you're constantly walking around like this, you're pretty much blissfully moving forward with your code. God bless you, enjoy it while it lasts. But you've got to keep refreshing code. You've got to be expanding your cognition. That's the worldview story. It's all about creating new insights, refreshing and expanding your cognition. And when you do that in the ending payoff of the story and people come together and do that, it expands the greater story and that creates catharsis. So revelation is more about kind of coming to some sort. I can see it more as a tool of propaganda, if you ask me, because in my estimation, everything is two things. It's not one thing. So when somebody comes to that's a revelation. That's pretty good. So I guess I'm talking over myself. But the revelation is more like insight generation, which is, you know, the big insight turn, usually at the beginning of the ending payoff or the end of the middle build too. So I'll have more to, let me think on that some more.
Okay. I think we'll end there.
Great.
Thanks, Sean. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody, for being here, and we will see you soon.